Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us on this damp Thursday afternoon. You're tuned to The Record on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. I'm in for Bill Radke. You can join us on Twitter at KUOW. Coming up this hour, we're going to talk with a Seattle artist about how she's responding to the ongoing refugee crisis in the Middle East and Africa. And Cecile Richards, the outgoing president of Planned Parenthood, tells us what it means to be an activist in the age of Trump. First, the ongoing crisis of homelessness in our affluent city. How can Seattle help people who are living in their vehicles? Almost 2 years ago, former Mayor Ed Murray opened RV lots around the city. The plan was for people who are living in cars or RVs to have a safe and legal place to park those vehicles, but the plan failed, and the city doesn't have a new one to replace it. Reporting on this issue for the Seattle Times is Viana Davila. I asked her what exactly was Mayor Murray's original plan.
Mayor Murray's plan, which launched in winter of 2016, was sort of an evolution of a previous safe parking program that had started in the 2011-2012 timeframe that really involved faith-based organizations, churches, things like that, offering a space here or there. His program, his idea was to make this bigger, to scale it up. And so they chose a number of locations to do what they called safe lots. They never opened as many as they wanted to. But the main one that people remember was in Ballard at the old Yankee Diner site. And then they were also going to have safe zones, which unlike a safe lot, which is fenced, has 24-hour security, safe zones would basically be areas where a person could park without being ticketed or towed for violating various parking laws.
All right, so that sounds like a logical idea. Why didn't it work?
One of the big things that the city certainly cites, you know, over and over again, is the cost of running the safe lot. It was in the neighborhood of $35,000 a month. A lot of that went to security, but there was also like a kitchen tent. There was, porta potties, that kind of thing, case management. And the flip side of that was they were getting very few people into housing. I think 11 out of a total of 96 people that they worked with over this particular period of time. So they shut that program down. And some advocates, I should say, really felt they should have given it more time. See, maybe it could have been reformed. You know, it was only open from, I think, you know, very early 2016 till August 2016, the safe lot itself.
Wow. There is one lot left, right, in the city?
Right. And the city always wants to say it's not a lot, it's a safe zone. But to anyone else, we would call it a lot. It's down in Soto. It's at 2nd Avenue and Spokane Viaduct. And it is it's really state right-of-way. I think it's SDOT right-of-way. It's now, I think, 8 RVs parked there on this sort of pothole-laden lot. No fencing, no security. There's a collection of porta potties in the middle. And that's where a handful of people still live.
I'm talking about the failed safe lot plan for the city of Seattle with Seattle Times reporter Viana Davila. Just because the city isn't following through with this plan, Viana, doesn't mean that people aren't still living in their vehicles. And in fact, I understand that population is growing, correct?
Right. At least since 2012, the vehicle population, the population of folks living in their vehicles has definitely grown. I think it was the one night count in 2012 was around 719 people. Last year's point in time count, it was 2,300. And so we still don't know yet. The point in time count happened a couple months ago. We won't know those numbers till June or May. But I think it's probably safe to say it's growing.
Are those vehicles dispersed through the city, or are they concentrated in particular areas of town?
You know, they're dispersed through the city, but you can get a sense of where particularly the RVs are. If you look at complaints, people calling in or filing an online complaint about them in Seattle itself, they tend to be clustered in industrial areas. And that's probably because that's the only place RVs can legally park overnight, is an industrial area. So Ballard, Soto, those kinds of things.
When you think about people living in vehicles, is there a distinction between car living and RV living, people who are in one or the other?
This goes a little bit to perception and maybe a little reality. Folks who are living in cars or trucks with smaller vehicles, they're generally thought to be newer to homelessness. They're generally thought to be more open to housing because it's just not very convenient particularly if you have a family, to live in a very small vehicle. And then the flip side of that, RV dwellers are thought to be harder to get into housing because they have what in many ways can be a house. Now, those houses, I'm putting air quotes if you could see them, are often in some terrible states of disrepair. You know, they don't necessarily have functioning kitchens. They might, but they often don't. You know, there's a lot of resale that goes on. They're sold at auction. So people can get them pretty cheap, but they are cheap for a reason. But it's also one of the only alternatives you can get to affordable housing here.
So given the failure of Mayor Murray's plan, given the fact that we have an increase in the number of people counted, at least living in their vehicles, and who knows what the actual count is, what is the city planning right now?
Well,
wow, that says it all.
Yeah, there are things being discussed at the city level. I don't want to act like there aren't. But I think the first thing I should say is there is no specific plan for the safe lots or the safe zone. Mayor Durkin has said she's reevaluating the safe zone, the last safe zone, and its cost, and then also looking at its influence on the surrounding neighborhood, which has been a concern of business owners. But that's about it with the lot itself. So I want to get that out there. The city had shifted money in the budget process back in the fall. They considered putting money into a second navigation team, which does outreach to folks living in unauthorized tent encampments. And they had thought about creating a second one focused on vehicles. That didn't happen. They put it into another program called LEAD, it's Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, which works with folks who have drug offenses. And it's like a diversion program.
Right.
And the hope is that they can focus on people in vehicles. But that's narrow, right? Because that means you have to have a drug offense on your record.
Oh, I see. So you're not saying they're setting up a separate LEAD that would focus on vehicles. You have to be on, have a drug offense and live in a vehicle.
Right.
I get it. Okay.
So you're already narrowing that population.
Okay.
They've said they're looking to the state to get money to, again, start a navigation team to work with folks in vehicles. But this is a lot of, and they're also working on doing better trash mitigation around RVs. But that, to me, is not a strategy yet.
It seems like there's a couple of questions. One is, how do the people in their vehicles feel about the lack of plan?
I think there's a lot of frustration out there. You know, the people in the lot, again, that's a handful of people.
Right.
Have mixed feelings. You know, they, in a lot of ways, are at least happy they have somewhere to be without fear of being ticketed. There's some frustration with the conditions of the lot. There's some frustration with the fact that right now the city isn't accepting any new folks to live in that lot. So there's just a really, I mean, that's a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the people who are in vehicles on the streets. And I think they, you know, I've talked to folks at the police department who say, you know, we try not to target people if we know they're living in a vehicle. We try not to target vehicles at our homes. But then you hear on the flip side, advocates say that's not true or it's very inconsistent.
And what about the broader community, especially in these neighborhoods that tend to see more people living in their vehicles?
There's a ton of frustration. There's a ton of frustration. You can see that we had requested complaints about vehicles from January 1st, 2017 to the present. And people are angry. People, they don't understand why these RVs are there. Even if there's not really anything specific that a person in an RV or a vehicle has done, I think just seeing it, you get this very visceral reaction from residents. They feel like they're taking over and they're frustrated that the city hasn't come up with a plan.
Some community members feel the same way about tent encampments or the tiny houses that are going up in various places. And it seems like this is an ongoing source of tension whenever we're talking about how to address the homeless crisis in the city of Seattle. It also seems like every time we get a new administration, we see a reinvention of the wheel in some way.
I think you're right. And of course, we're in an interesting situation in Seattle in that we've had multiple administrations in a very short period of time, just in the last 6 months or so. So that obviously, I think, has had an effect on things. Mayor Murray, of course, I guess almost three years ago now, declared the state of emergency on homelessness. So I feel like we're still in that period. Like, I don't think anybody's said, any administration has said, this is not an issue. I do not get a sense, though, from the current administration, necessarily the sense of urgency that maybe a lot of people feel.
That's Viana Davila. She's a reporter for the Seattle Times Project Homeless. You're with The Record on KUOW. You're with The Record on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. I'm in for Bill Radke. Two reports released this month show a decline in opioid prescriptions in states that have legalized medical marijuana. One report looked at Medicaid enrollees, the other, people who are on Medicare. Both find that weed can encourage lower prescription opioid use and serve as a harm abatement tool in the opioid crisis. We had a lot of questions about those studies, so we turned to Dr. Andrew Saxon to try to get some of the answers. He's a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the University of Washington, and he directs the Addiction Psychiatry Residence Program at the university. Welcome to our studios, Dr. Saxon.
Happy to be with you.
First, let's take a closer look at these two reports. One, as I mentioned, looked at Medicaid, the other at Medicare, and they both found some reduction in prescription opioids in states like Washington that have legalized medical marijuana. So how much did these prescriptions go down?
They went down by a few percentage points. So it wasn't a massive reduction, but it was a what we would call a statistically significant reduction. So that means that you would be unlikely to see those reductions by chance alone. It is important to point out that when you're looking at epidemiologic data like these data, we're not looking at the behavior of any individual person. And so we can't say with certainty that the existence of medical marijuana laws and the legal availability of marijuana is what drove down the prescribing of opioids. We can only say with certainty that these two events are associated.
People seemed pretty excited about this nevertheless.
Well, I think people are excited because at least it opens the door to the potential that medical marijuana might be an intervention that could be used for some people who have chronic pain rather than using opioids. So given the fact that we're in a very serious epidemic where many more people are dying from drug overdoses than from auto accidents or even from suicides, where more people died from overdoses in 1 year than all the Americans who died during the 20 years of the Vietnam War, anything that we can do that might help, we have to try every option.
What was your reaction when you first heard about these results?
My first reaction actually was surprise. After reading them carefully and seeing that the methodology was very sound and that they used statistical controls to examine many other characteristics of the states that do and don't have medical marijuana, and they differ in many, many other ways, as you might imagine. It was sophisticated techniques that were very well done. So I think the data are convincing that this is a real phenomenon that occurs. And again, what we don't know is the absolute cause of it.
The reports were published in the JAMA Internal Medicine Review. That's the Journal of American Medical Association's internal medicine publication. You're saying that there's significance, but that medical marijuana is not a silver bullet when it comes to helping prevent opioid abuse?
So I'm saying that it could have potential as one tool that we could use to deal with this epidemic, but the epidemic is complicated and there are many, many other things that we would need to do. I also should add that we've been relying on medications to help people with chronic pain, and there are medications other than opioids and other than marijuana that can help, but there also are non-medication interventions that can be very potent that are not widely available because, number one, the healthcare system doesn't pay people to provide those, and we haven't trained the workforce to do that.
The University of Washington used to have a pain center, and it was not about prescribing opioids. It really was talking about different kinds of pain relief therapies. And as I understand it, when you talk about the healthcare system, you're talking specifically about insurance reimbursement, right?
Yes.
So does that pain center still exist?
Well, the pain center does still exist. It has altered its characteristics over time, but as it currently exists, the focus is on trying to use therapies that are not opioids and in many cases are not medication. Probably the most potent one is actually a form of psychotherapy called cognitive behavioral therapy, and that's been shown to improve chronic pain in randomized controlled trials. In brief, what it's trying to do is change people's thoughts and attitudes about their pain. And to really explain how that works, I have to go into a little bit about the physiology of pain and the purpose of pain. And so why do we have pain? Why should we have to suffer? Well, we have pain for a very important evolutionary purpose, which is a way for the body to tell our brain when we're doing something that might be dangerous to our survival. And unfortunately, that doesn't always work right, and sometimes there's pain when there is no danger. And that's often the situation with people who have chronic pain, that their body's telling them, you can't move, you can't try things, that would be dangerous, you might even die if you did that. And yet there really is no danger. And actually, if they move and they're active, that might end up helping the pain. So one of the things that the cognitive behavioral therapy does is help people change these thoughts and beliefs about their pain to give them the freedom that they have more safety than what these very powerful chemical messages their body and their brain are getting tell them they're not safe. And so that kind of intervention, which can take more time and effort but can be sustained over a long period of time, can be very helpful.
I'm talking with Dr. Andrew Saxon, a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the University of Washington. And as you're describing that, Dr. Saxon, it sounds reasonable, but it also sounds like anathema to our instant gratification culture. We're used to getting a pill, ordering something online, and having it delivered in 2 hours. I mean, that is how our society has been socialized at this point in time. So it would seem that there'd be a lot of resistance from patients to embark in something that would take longer to change behavior or at least change how they feel about their body's reactions to pain.
I would say that that is accurate, that that might be most people's first reaction. You really want me to spend 8 or 12 weeks of my life working on this problem when I'm pretty sure medication's the only thing that can help me? So we do need to bring people along, and some patients are more willing to do that than others, and most find that they do get some benefit from it.
So to go back to these two studies that we began talking about, basically, they're interesting to you, but they're not definitive. Is that fair to say?
Well, they are not definitive in the sense that we can say if we make medical marijuana available to patients, patients will use less opioids. So we'd need a more granular study of actual patients to find that out, which would be actually a challenging study to do. But again, I think it's hopeful that at least in the climate where people have medical marijuana available, the chances that there'd be less opioid prescribing are higher. And well, there also is a study done several years ago showing that the overdose rates were going down in the states that had medical marijuana. So I think there is converging evidence that probably as a harm reduction strategy, making marijuana more readily available might make sense without us saying, gee, that is going to be the solution to this opioid crisis, because it's much more complicated than that. And there's a lot of other interventions that we need to bring to bear to really address the crisis.
Dr. Andrew Saxon, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the University of Washington. He also is director of the Addiction Psychiatry Residency Program at UW. Thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This is The Record from KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. I'm in today for Bill Radke. Last Saturday, in a Damascus, Syria suburb, residents were victims of a suspected chemical attack. In an interview for NPR's Morning Edition, Muad al-Din described what happened next.
I have been evacuated from Douma to northern area in Syria. It's a camp. There's a tent to contains the evacuated people. It's really devastating, the circumstances. It's 36 hours on the road, no break. Really, it's a hard thing to feel with you have a family and you have two kids with you. It's really hard.
Muad al-Din's story, I heard that this morning on Morning Edition, just stopped me in my car. He and his family have joined one of the largest waves of displaced people in history. Many of us have become almost numb to stories of the contemporary refugee crisis. Seattle artist Marianne Peters wants to make it impossible for us to look away. Marianne Peters, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you.
You have been working as an artist for decades, but your current artwork emerged not all that long ago, and I understand it came from a confluence, a story about a fisherman and an interchange with Doctors Without Borders. Can you tell us more?
Well, that's one of the stories that I bumped into. I should give you a little background. In 2010, I went to Lebanon and to Damascus with my family. My grandparents were from an area called Mount Lebanon, and identified as Lebanese, although at that time it was just Syria. And I wanted to somehow understand the historical framework beyond my nostalgia about it. And so I started applying for grants and looking for opportunities to rethink what I think is a really full and complicated history that most people don't know about. And I started making the work because I felt somewhat of an obligation. And I think I had the empathy to do it and the chutzpah to do it at that time in my life. And so I started 3 years ago making this work. The piece you asked me about, that was based on being invited to do a talk at the Arab Festival in at the Seattle Center, actually. Mm. And while I was there, I met a nurse who was working with Doctors Without Borders. I had started doing a series called Impossible Monuments, which in my mind refers to those events or incidents that are under the radar, but that inform larger topics and deserve reverence and would never be elevated to the status of a monument. This nurse with Doctors Without Borders shared with me that he had been working in Yemen and that Yemeni fishermen were going out to do their work and were surprisingly coming across the remains and the belongings of people who did not survive those crossings. And they came to Doctors Without Borders and asked them for assistance in how to retrieve these people and their belongings, and also how to show respect for the traditions of burial with those people. And I was kind of completely struck by the fact that I didn't know Doctors Without Borders would go the extra mile to do that. And I also was struck by what the experience would be of being just an innocent fisherman on the Mediterranean and coming across what is now turned into somewhat of a cataclysmic occurrence. And I made this work called Impossible Monument Flotsam.
We are going to have some photos of Marianne's work, some of Marianne's work, at our website, kuow.org, later today. So you can, if you haven't seen it, you can click over and get a look at some of these images. You mentioned that your grandparents are of Lebanese origin.
Yes.
You went back. How do you think that ancestral vantage point influences the way that you interpret the stories?
Well, I think, in truth, I'm not a scholar. I'm not a historian. I basically am, I'd have to say, being an investigative, benevolent snoop around histories that are tied to my relatives. I felt that what I could do as a second-generation Arab American was use that perspective, which is unique unto itself, and record through artwork the what I will call the footprint, the cultural footprint of people being in a state of flux, which included my relatives at one time, and which is linked to current events. And so that's what I've been doing. I've been following migration patterns that happened at the turn of the 20th century with the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and looking at those records that I can find and comparing it to today.
You said you're not a scholar, you're a snoop, but you're also an artist. And how is the perspective that an artist brings to these real life issues, different from the way a journalist or a scholar would interpret them?
Well, I'm an interpreter of events. I rely on the scholarship and the expertise of journalists and historians to be the purveyors of, as best as possible, the accurate information. But I feel like I can bring a format and a form to topics that are based in reality, but that have a different kind of resonance by the way that I present them.
So these are not regular realistic photographs or or realistic paintings. Can you describe, this is radio, so people can't see. Can you describe any of it for our listeners?
Yes. Well, I have made pieces that are loosely painted as if you were on the field, images that are tied to incidents that are contemporary. And I'm calling those storyboards, much like a theater person would put together a storyboard, and that narrative adds up to something. Sometimes I come across a piece of information that I feel is pertinent, but that would not have stuck in the mindset of most of the public. And in this case, I'll describe a piece that I did that was based on drought in the Middle East. There are some who are identifying the drought that is affecting current events in Syria, and the region is like hundreds of years old. And I read about how farmers had, tried to impress upon the government their demise, that their crops were failing and that it was going to affect not only the economics but the livelihood of people specifically of the country, and that there wasn't the response that they wanted to have, and it made for this influx of millions of people to urban settings that are not prepared for them. And so I thought, how can I get people to understand drought? So I started thinking about what's grown, and in this case wheat, and how bread is so integral to the cuisine. And I made a carpet with the help of another artist, Mackenzie Port. My concept was to take a ubiquitous Middle Eastern image, the carpet, flying carpet, and I made it out of baking flour, only out of baking flour. So if you touched it, it disseminated. And it was called Impossible Monument on My Eyes and My Head. That expression, on my eyes and my head, in Arabic, it translates to how we would use in English to say, I would do anything for you. And I also bronzed a set of pita breads.
That was also an impossible monument.
That was the original impossible monument.
Did you ever have any hesitation to pursue this line of work?
Always. yes, because it's not the first time I had made installations or pieces that were tied to my Arab heritage. But it took the collapse of the Arab Spring and the kind of humanitarian crisis that has become this migration moment to kind of get me to say, also to acknowledge that people of Arab descent are being maligned on a regular basis in this country, and that if I could bring some sort of different mental picture to the topics that are surrounding such a diverse and huge topic, then I would try to do it. And I happen to have a very generous and empathetic art dealer, James Harris, who when I came to him and said, I really want to try to do this, they're not going to be synchronized. The title is going to be the cohesion for what people see. And I'm going in. And so between him and my family and my friends, and I just decided I had nothing to lose.
It's a moment in time when you're working when many artists feel called to address various contemporary social issues, political issues, identity politics.
Yes.
What can an artist, not just you, but artists in general, bring to bear that other kinds of storytellers and interpreters can't?
Well, we have there's no rules. So, of course, if you can realize an idea in a resonant way, that it's endless, the possibilities of that. I will interject that there is an ethical premise that you have to grapple with. So if I'm talking about drowned people in the Mediterranean, I have to really think about what that means to those families and those cultures that are in these forced circumstances. And if whatever I do has to have some element of respect to the experience. And so I think about that a lot before I make something. But artists, I think, have the latitude of that there, as I said, there's no rules. And so if they can find circumstances that will accommodate their ideas, they can actually contribute.
This journey, this body of work that you're engaged with right now started with some recognition or acknowledgement of your own heritage. How has it changed how you think about who you are and who your ancestors were?
Well, it sure has made family stories different.
Really?
You know, of course. I mean, because as any family will do that has an attachment. I mean, America is a giant narrative of stories, right? Of people coming from other places, unless you're of Native descent. And it's made me look at those stories and look at those images with a different kind of filter. I think there are aspects of my family's stories that have been romanticized, of course. There are aspects that have been embellished hugely. But it all comes down to some sort of need to have an association that is culturally strong. And rather than minimize that, I think, you know, I mean, Lebanese heritage, I would tell everybody, go to Lebanon. It's, you know, go to Lebanon. Do it. But and every time I've sort of headed in that direction, I've been cautioned not to go, you know, because we have such an imagined landscape about what that means to go to a place like that. But it's just a fiction. And so it's made me really look at what are the realities and what are the fictions. And it's made me also look at the overlap of histories. I mean, Lebanon's a really good place to look because it's so diverse in that way. And people don't realize that, you know.
Makes me want to go to Lebanon. But also think about your work. Artist Marianne Peters, a painter and installation artist who's based in Seattle. Her current body of work inspired by the humanitarian crisis driven by migration out of the Middle East and Africa, and also by her own identity search. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me, Marcy.
And a reminder that you'll be able to see some of Marianne's work at our website, kuow.org. It's The Record. When the price of one Bitcoin soared to almost $20,000 late last year, an influx of entrepreneurs and developers came to the Pacific Northwest in search of cheap hydropower. But now cities, counties, and utilities in central Washington are hitting the pause button. The cryptocurrency businesses bring tech jobs, but they're also electricity hogs. KOW's Tom Bonsi has this report from Wenatchee.
You'd hardly guess without inside info that cryptocurrency fortunes are made and lost here on the edge of East Wenatchee. The best giveaway that something big is going on are the massive cooling fans. That's the nonstop 24/7 clatter and hum that maybe you can hear a little in the background. The fans are cooling specialized computer chipsets just packed to the brim inside modified cargo containers in front of me or just a little ways down the road inside of huts.
There is huge emerging technology opportunity for this region to maintain a first mover advantage in this technology space.
Malachi Salcido developed one of these Bitcoin mines, which are all about computing power rather than digging minerals. The digital miners earn cryptocurrency, virtual money, for processing and recording global network transactions 24/7. The draw of the Wenatchee Valley is its rock-bottom power rates, thanks to abundant hydropower, and the mild climate, helpful for efficient cooling. But cities and counties in north central Washington seem unsure whether to embrace this new line of business.
Good evening, everybody.
In the past month and a half, the Wenatchee City Council, the City of East Wenatchee, and city councils in nearby Leavenworth, Eniat, and Chelan have all passed emergency zoning controls or outright moratoriums on cryptocurrency operations.
Indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Much of this action was spurred by the Chelan County Electric Utility, which has its own moratorium on processing new hookups for large loads. PUD Customer Service Director Andy Wendell and colleagues made the rounds of local governments.
We're not sure exactly how much of the cryptocurrency that the community would like us to serve, and so that's one of the major questions that we want, is how much do you want? And if you do want it in your community, where do you plan for it?
Wendell says the specialized data centers that process and record virtual currency transactions suck electricity big time, and there's only so much spare electric capacity left.
The cryptocurrency applications, many of them that we're getting, are taking up all of the remaining capacity in distribution circuits that were designed to bring on schools and housing and other commerce, other organic growth.
The Chelan County Board is next in line to consider emergency zoning controls on cryptocurrency operations. County Commissioner Keith Gaynor says it makes sense to take a time out before getting overwhelmed.
We hope we're on the front end. We don't want to play defense and come, you know, in a reactive mode. We'd rather be proactive.
Bitcoin miner Malachi Salcido says the local governments and utilities should be careful not to kill a goose that lays golden eggs. He founded and runs Salcido Enterprises in Wenatchee.
If the policies are too onerous, or if they take too long to develop and implement, this development opportunity will go elsewhere.
Salcido says a $100 million expansion he envisions in the Wenatchee Valley will likely be delayed. He says he'll redirect the Bitcoin data center investment to another western state instead, but wouldn't say where. I'm Tom Botsey in Wenatchee, Washington.
It's been a busy 15 months for Cecile Richards. The outgoing president of Planned Parenthood has sparred with the Republican Congress, and she's taken a lot of flack to preserve funding for women's reproductive health care, including abortion services. But this fight was nothing new for Richards. She grew up with politics. Her dad was a civil rights lawyer and a labor activist, and her mother was the outspoken feminist and one-term Texas governor, Ann Richards. So Cecile was weaned on activism. Now she takes a look at her past and looks ahead to the future in a new book. It's called Make Trouble. I asked Cecile how she navigated the shadows her two parents cast.
Right out of college, I became a labor organizer, which I don't think was ever their dream for me. I mean, I don't know what aspirations they had. And so I've always had the privilege of actually working in social justice in some way. And I really wasn't in the shadow of Ann Richards in the sense that, as you say, for most of my life, she was my mom. That was pretty much her identity. And it wasn't until much later, actually, I already had my own daughter, Lily, when she ran for governor. So, but that was, again, back in a day when, boy, when mom said she was going to run for governor, it was like, everybody come home. We're all, you know, we're all doing this. And so I feel like we all lived through that with her. And it was never a matter of being in her shadow. It was really more a matter of like, this is what we do as a family. And of course, but I cannot, there is not a week that passes that someone doesn't stop me and say, I love your mom. And which is, in fact, it happened this morning at Microsoft. And I think that it's a real, I mean, for me, it's a real honor. Obviously, I feel very, very lucky. I was born under a lucky star, having Ann Richards as a mom. And I feel like she's with me all the time in this work.
One of my favorite stories from this memoir comes early on. You are 13. It's the midst of the maybe not in Texas, but the rest, the anti-Vietnam War era. The Vietnam War is raging. And you decide to launch your own personal protest.
Well, I just, yeah, we had just moved to Austin, which of course for my parents was this huge relief, because suddenly there were love-ins and sit-ins and marches, and people were tie-dyeing their clothes and just doing all kinds of wacky things. But then there was the moratorium against the war was called, and so I found out from some other kids that there was going to be people were wearing black armbands in opposition to the war. So even though I was at a new school, I thought, well, I'll do that. And so I carefully cut out my little felt armband and wore it. And the first thing that happened at school was, of course, the principal, who I will never forget, Tom Heston. You know, I don't know where he is today, but I feel like I owe him a debt of gratitude. He called me immediately to his office and he said, "Do your parents know what you're doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm pretty sure they do." But he proceeded to try to reach my mother, which his good luck that she wasn't answering that day. But it was interesting there in seventh grade to feel like suddenly, I mean, I didn't even know the principal. And suddenly, just by wearing a black armband, I'm in his office. And even though it was frightening in a way, it was incredibly exhilarating. And I feel like it kind of got me on my path in a funny way.
I mean, really, you went off to college, to Brown University, and you were an activist and student at the same time. I think you did finally graduate.
I finally did. I was on the 5-year plan, but yes, I did. I did eventually graduate.
But it almost seems like the social justice work was by far more important than getting that BA.
Oh, absolutely. As I like to think, I majored in history, but I minored in activism, and everything was happening then. And that's part of the reason I was actually attracted to Brown. I mean, the janitors went on strike on campus, and I got involved in that. And then, of course, there was the move to divest from South Africa, which is so interesting because I see now the parallels mm-hmm. with a lot of the divestment movements on campuses. And at the time, they thought we were crazy. They thought these students, you know, you're nuts. This is never going to happen. And then, of course, Brown actually became one of the first universities to divest. And the rest is history, if you will. You know,
I'm talking with Cecile Richards, who's just published a memoir called Make Trouble. She still has a few more weeks as the head of Planned Parenthood, a job that would seem more than full time as well. It doesn't seem like a natural progression to be the kind of grassroots organizer that you and your husband were together, traveling the country, working, organizing just the sort of the folks who really are down and dirty in the ditches, people who are healthcare workers and people who are field workers and laundry. I mean, you were really at the bottom. It wasn't like you were organizing. I don't know what I suppose that white collar executives don't necessarily have a union now that I think about it.
Right.
But
you know, like minimum women. Mainly women working for the minimum wage, mainly women of color, many of whom, you know, just have never had a break.
So it seems that there were lessons to learn that in reading your book, I see you applied, but it doesn't seem like a natural jump to go from labor organizing to politics and public policy, which was sort of the midterm there, and then into Planned Parenthood. What's the through line between all those things?
Well, I think I was always very lucky to be able to have my job be something that actually brought enormous meaning to me. And part of what I talk about in the book is having spent those years working with hotel workers and janitors and nursing home workers, many of whom had no options. I mean, particularly women of color in these cities. And yet they were so courageous. They were willing to risk everything just to try to get just dignity and respect on the job. And so I guess my through line, if there is one in this sort of crazy spaghetti bowl of a career, has been trying to empower folks who just need a leg up, need a lift up. And it's interesting to finally come to Planned Parenthood, an organization that, of course, is 100 years old and has this incredible legacy. But many of the same women that I was organizing in those hotels, they depend on Planned Parenthood for health care. So for me, it's a natural progression.
But still a scary jump for you.
Oh, my gosh. I had no idea what I was doing. I mean, I tell about the book. I almost didn't go to the interview. I'd been called by the search firm, and I thought, oh, my gosh. I called my husband. I said, "Kirk, this is amazing, you know, Planned Parenthood." But then I really got cold feet. And so I was not going to go to the interview. And, I did what any grown woman would do. I called my mother, and I said, "Mom, I don't think I have the experience. You know, the kids are still in school, et cetera, et cetera." All the reasons women always put up for why they don't do things. And she said, "Are you kidding, Cecile?" She said, "You have got to go to that interview." She said, "What's the worst thing that could happen?" And she was a big believer in that because she too had waited so much of her life. to jump in. And so I went, and that thank goodness she told me to do that.
I'm talking with Cecile Richards. Her new memoir is called Make Trouble with Lauren Peterson, and it's a story of you. It's a story of your mom. It's a story about the progressive movement, and it's also a sort of a lesson for folks. I read that you started writing this like immediately after Trump's election.
Pretty much. I mean, I felt like every day someone was stopping me on the street saying, what should I do? As if there were some magical thing that they could do and make it all go away or change, you know, sort of roll back the clock. And I realized, well, instead of talking to everybody on the subway and the train and, you know, on the street, I'll write a book. And it was really, I'm sure it was partly therapeutic, but I hope it's also instructive that it is a memoir, but it is really about a call to action. And I think that it's important to recognize that not everybody is going to quit their job and now become a full-time activist, but everything that everyone is doing is adding up to something so big and so powerful that it's, I think everyone can do more than they ever thought they would before. And that's what we need to do right now.
You end your book talking about the Women's March. Another huge set of marches across the country just recently happened, the March for Our Lives, organized by teenagers. What went through your mind when you heard first about those marches being organized?
Well, I mean, of course, total exhilaration. And then having the chance to be in Washington for the march, it's funny because we talked earlier about my, you know, being called to the principal's office. I met a young woman stop me on the street and she said, hi, I got kicked out of my school last week for walking out because I'm in a very conservative area. And so I was suspended. And I just said, good for you. And because there she was now at the march in Washington coming down from Pennsylvania. And I thought, basically, this is seeing a whole generation of young activists doing it even when they say you can't, speaking out in their own words. And to me, that's what we've been doing at Planned Parenthood these last 12 years, is investing in a whole new generation of activists and leaders that are going to change this country. And it's not immediate. It's not overnight. But no one could have been at those marches without seeing how powerful it was to have young people speaking up and speaking out.
So you sound so optimistic. When does it all fall apart for you?
Well, look, I mean, I write about this in the book. The morning after, you know, Hillary's defeat was crushing, but not just for me. I mean, I went to the Planned Parenthood office and where our staff who had left everything on the field. I mean, they had just my daughters, you know, who had and my son. It was as if they had never lived under anything other than really a progressive president, at least. And so I think it is important to acknowledge that this was a huge setback, but it also has been a rallying cry. And so I guess if you're an organizer, you just have to be a perennial optimist. And I do believe that not only that the country is on our side, but I really think the future is on our side. I mean, going back to Texas this week, it is now a majority minority state. I was in Houston, which is, I think, the most diverse city in the country now. And it is changing everything. And so I just feel like this is an opportunity for us to mobilize, to support young people, to support movements, to get to know people outside of our own movements, because that is actually how we are going to change things.
So talking to people outside your own movements, how do we do that?
I think it's just, I've been encouraging people to do this in that, you know, maybe your passion is reproductive rights, but you know, go to a meeting with the immigration rights groups and meet some of the leaders locally, or go to a meeting with Black Lives Matter and understand how they're organizing, get to know the leaders there, because that to me is something that we just have to take time to do now. And I think we also have to, you know, one of the things about being good organizers and leaders is we have to listen to people. And that means sometimes it's not about convincing someone else of your point of view. It's actually listening to hear where they're coming from. And I do feel that there are millions of people in this country who aren't really being listened to and who, if we took the trouble and time to do it, are there with us. But we just have to do more outreach than we've been doing. And that's another thing I'm looking forward to doing in the next few months.
There's also been a lot of talk for folks to reach out and really try to understand people that they absolutely don't agree with. We are seeing this giant chasm between points of view in America at this point. The gulf seems huge. Have you talked to a lot of folks that don't agree with you and you don't agree with in a more dialogue kind of manner?
I think, yes, and actually one of the things that we've really worked on at Planned Parenthood is understanding that using these kind of political binary, this pro-choice, pro-life, isn't really helping. It isn't really, we're missing a lot of the conversation. And I think there are a lot more people, in the middle in this country, who see that this is an issue that's personal and it's also complex for them. And so not talking past people is really important. And even just hearing where they're coming from, I do think it's important as organizers that we don't set out believing that we have to convince everybody about the rightness of our cause. I hear a lot of people, particularly, I live on the East Coast now, and a lot of folks who will say, well, people are voting against their interests. Why do they do that? And I do have to say, you know, have you ever stopped and actually talked to somebody about their lives and what their interests may be? I do fundamentally believe we have more in common in this country than what it would appear to be if you watch cable news. And so sometimes just taking the time to open up to others is really, I think it's a good thing to do.
Are you going to run for office?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not planning on it. I don't know what I'm going to do next, but I'm really excited about the future. I feel like it's a really good time to sort of step aside and make room for a new leader at Planned Parenthood, but I will be a lifelong advocate, marcher, you name it. I think that it's an exciting time because women to me right now are the most important and potent political force in this country. And I want to spend at least in these next few months doing everything I can to make sure that folks are registered to vote, that they know what's happening in Washington and what's happening and why voting matters, and turn everybody out that we can in November.
Cecile Richards, thanks so much for coming by.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Cecile Richards is the outgoing president of Planned Parenthood. Her new book is called Make Trouble, Standing Up, Speaking Out. Well, that's all for today. Go out and make some trouble. The record's produced by Amina Al-Saji, Adjua, Juma Brempong, Casey Martin, and Bree Ripley is with me in the studio, our social media producer. Tomorrow on The Record, Ross Reynolds brings you The Week in Review. I'm Marcy Silman. Thanks for listening.